Shining Giants of Sephardic Jewry, a four-part series. As is our tradition, the June series is free of charge, and unfortunately, I'm going to have to, after this series, take a break for July and August. But we'll be resuming at the end of August, hopefully with a class before Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah is in early September this year. And then we'll move on from there into the year. I'm looking forward to a full slate of classes, I hope, for the year ahead. If you have ideas for topics, please do send them to me. I'd be very interested. I'm also hoping that in the fall we'll actually be in person as opposed to being on only Zoom, although we'll probably have a Zoom option available. We have a lot of people who have been joining in from afar. We have a few people who are in Israel who are here this morning. And people are still able to participate, that would be wonderful. You may have noticed that that there are words at the bottom of your screen. We're trying out something new. Zoom has a live transcript option, which isn't bad as long as one person at a time. If multiple people are speaking, it gets a little dicey. So if you don't want it, if you find it to be a distraction, you are able to turn it off. There's an option for hiding the transcript at the bottom of your screen. But this is just because not all of us hear very well on Zoom. So another way potentially to make the class more accessible for people. Finally, I want to dedicate learning this morning in memory of somebody who wanted to be here this morning and passed away on Monday, and that's Perley Hermont, who I think many of you knew. So she should benefit from the learning that we do this morning. So here's what I want to do for this series. I want to start out with a brief description of the origins of Sephardic Jewry, going back to the 10th, 11th centuries. And what we're really going to focus on is the Spanish segment of Sephardic Jewry, just because Sephardic Jewry as a whole is very large. You have that entire North Africa area that we're only going to talk about a little bit in the beginning, but we're going to really focus on Spain for this. And when we talk about Spain and the beginnings of Sephardic Jewry, so we have to talk about the person who's going to be our focus for the morning, Shmuel ben Yosef Halevi ibn Nagrela, or in some versions ibn Nagdila, I've seen. Also known as Shmuel Hanagid. The word Nagid means leader or prince, and that's who we're going to focus on for the bulk of our time today. We're going to see that Shmuel HaNagid is a giant as a political leader. He is a giant as a scholar of Judaism. And interestingly, we have a ton of information about him, even though he lived 1,000 years ago. Usually when you're dealing with trying to reconstruct a life from that period, you don't have that much to go on. But with him, we have his own letters and poems. We have documents that were found in the Cairo Geniza in Egypt, something we've talked about on other occasions, this storehouse of documents that people put away for various reasons over centuries. We have biographical information about him from Jewish and Arab writers from his time and the generations immediately afterwards. There's a lot of information in writing about him. So we have a lot to go on. As an introduction to Shmuel HaNagid himself, before we go back to talk about the history of Sephardic Judaism on the whole, and I'm just putting the link again in the chat for the source sheet, I brought you on the sheet four verses of his. They're on different themes. They're on different, they're each of a different nature. You can see as you look at the source sheet that two out of the four are taken from the Penguin Book of Hebrew Verse, and two of them I translated from his work Ben Mishlei, which we're going to talk about. But there are four poems, or four verses, really. The first one, I'm going to read aloud in the Hebrew before we look at the English. Usually, I don't read the Hebrew out loud, but here I want to, because it gives you more of a feel of it as a poem when you hear it in the original, the way that he intended it. Me'adam b'mar'ehu ve'arev l'shotehu u'mazug be'aspamya v'zichro elehodu v'chalash be'agonav aval ba'aloto el rashim azai yardeh b'rashim asher yerdu v'shachul asher damav mechusim b'dim Yegonav bidam eshkal, yinusun eshkol, yinusun v'yerdu, ki ilu yedidim et yisubum ashishotav miyad liyad goral ale yahalom yadu. So I don't know if that actually helped or not, doing it that way. It is entertaining to see how the transcription did it. did not think about the way that was going to come across. Nonetheless, you see the translation there in the English. Red to the eye, sweet to the drinker, it is poured out in Spain, but its bouquet reaches India. When it is in the bowls, it is feeble. But once it goes to the head, it holds sway over swaying heads. And that's, their translation did a nice job there of capturing the language in the Hebrew. Rashim azai yirdeh, rashim asher yirdu. The wretch whose heart's blood is mixed with his tears banishes his sorrows with the grape's blood. As the goblets make their rounds, passing from hand to hand, it seems as if the friends are casting lots for a diamond. What do you make of this poem? I've looked at it a lot, so I'm not going to weigh in. What do you make of this? Sorry? Oh, that's interesting. I thought it was about wine. I took it as straight wine. It's nice to see an added layer. It's an interesting idea, especially because the work in which this was published in Hebrew, his Ben Tehillim, is actually about, is actually mostly religious poetry. So the idea that there's another layer is not, it is not beyond thought. It could really be so.
If it's about wine, why does it say, it seems as if the friends are casting lots for a diamond? Clearly it's a metaphor.
So I definitely hear the idea coming in as a metaphor. I think you could argue, though, that he's trying to emphasize the way people are attached to the wine. In other words, they treat the wine like it's a diamond as the goblets make the rounds. That's the way I had assumed. But I definitely hear the other possibility. Was that previous comment, was that Professor Sakin? Okay, so coming from a professor of literature, I will definitely keep that in mind. I think that what you're seeing here, with the extra layer of metaphor or without the extra layer of metaphor, is a poem that I wouldn't have specifically associated with a Jewish sage. This is a Spanish, well, it's Hebrew, but it's a poem written in Spain about wine and an observation of the drinking experience, describing people drinking in different settings and in different moods. The translation is from that Penguin book. I would have differed from them a little bit, but overall it's a good translation. Take a look at the second one, please, which comes from his work Ben Mishlei, which, like the Hebrew book Mishlei found in Tanakh, is a little bit more of a moralizing text. So look at... There you go. Thank you. And I have to say, now that I'm listening to someone else speak and watching the way the transcript works, I hope no one really has to rely on the transcript. Nonetheless.
How do you get rid of it?
There's something called hide transcript. If you go to the bottom of your screen, choose from your options there, It might be under more. If you look under more, it might be there. Okay.
It's under CC.
Oh, okay.
It says under more. It's under more.
Okay, it depends on your. It depends on what you're using. Susan's using an iPad, which is different. The answer is I don't know. Take a look at the second one, please. The second poem, and again, I'm going to read out the Hebrew. Al na tihi chaver la rasha, gam al yihi rasha bechelkecha, ki hu elei risho yeshivecha, terem tishivehu litzid kecha. Which has a nice rhyme to it. He says, be not a friend to the wicked. Also let not a wicked person be in your portion. For he to his evil will draw you, before you draw him to your righteousness. That's my translation, not the Penguin Book. It's not a very poetic translation. His advice, and I see Jonathan, I see your hand, hang in there. He said, his advice here is that you shouldn't befriend wicked people thinking you're going to influence them. It's like Pirkei Avot. They know that he'll make you like him before you make him like you. That's the idea. There's a note in the chat from Rivka saying that if you're using an iPad, if you go to more, then meeting settings, closed captioning, and you could turn it off there. Thank you very much, Rivka. Jonathan, you were going to say? I don't hear. Okay. So this poem is very much a moralizing poem, essentially. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot which says, Al titchaber larasha, do not join with the wicked. Mark puts in the chat, Oy larasha, oy lishcheino, the idea, woe to the wicked, woe to their neighbor. It's a very simple and straightforward idea that he chose to record in verse. If you take a look at number three, you find a verse about war. And keep in mind as you read it that he actually was a minister of war. That was one of the portfolios that he held, as we'll see. He says, Krav dome berosho el yefefa, asher kol ish lisachek ba ya'aveh, visofo kizikena hameusa, asher kol shochara yivke v'yidveh. In the English, war is at first like a beautiful girl with whom all men long to play, but in the end, like a repulsive hag whose suitors all weep and ache. And that one comes from the Penguin Book. That's not my translation. I would have done that a little differently. But the message gets across, certainly. And this, by the way, is from Ben Mishlei, his moralizing work. So he says, you know, people like war in the beginning, but in the end, it just brings them to tears and to pain. Susan.
When he's writing this, is this the golden age where there were sort of worked with the Muslims?
We're going to talk about that. It's a very good question. And the answer is yes and no, as we'll see.
Okay.
As we'll see. One last poem. I'm just trying to show you the breadth of Shmuel. We've seen him have a poem about wine, which may have a metaphor layer to it. We see him here have these sort of moralizing, educational poems. And then here, you see a religious poem in number four. Bisam yirah terapei et choli libcha ve'enecha, uvelashon ma'aseh tatzdik asher diber lashonecha. Which is a very nice pun for those who follow the Hebrew. With the medicine of awe of God, you shall heal the sickness of your heart and your eyes. And with the tongue of deeds, you shall make just that which your tongue has spoken. In other words, your message should come across through action, right? The concept in Judaism of emor ma'at va'asei harbei, also Pirkei Avot, that you should speak little and do a lot. So let your deeds justify your that which you speak. So this is just, again, just to try to introduce you to him. He's talking in here about awe of God as a remedy for sin, actions as therapy for speech. I gave you in source number 5 on the sheet a reference to 2 must-reads for those who want more information about Shmuel HaNagid than we're going to get to today. The first one that I listed there is available on HebrewBooks.org. It is, as you see here, the Diwan of Shmuel HaNagid. It's a collection of his writings. It's in Hebrew, so you'd have to be able to manage the Hebrew. But it collects his poems. And then in the realm of English, from Elio Astor, The Jews of Muslim Spain, is a very, very useful work. It is a very, very good resource for the history of the period. And Shmuel in particular gives him a lot of space in the text, and draws on his writings, draws on Arabic sources as well. I recommend the whole series. It's a set of 3, but Shmuel is in volume 2. Okay, so let's talk history. First, I want to identify 2 populations clearly: the Arabs and the Berbers. The Arabs originate in the Arabian Peninsula, right? Primarily the area that we today call Saudi Arabia. They've been identified as an ethnic group for 3,000 years or more. Going back to the beginning of the first millennium before the Common Era, they were known as Arabs. On the other hand, you have the Berbers. The Berbers originate in North Africa. Okay, so they are significantly west of the Arab population. Really, from eastern Morocco, you have the Atlas mountain range. I should have maybe taken a map for this also. That would have been nice. All right. From the Atlas mountain range in eastern Morocco, all the way east to the western end of Egypt. That's where the Berbers are from. And you need to know those 2 populations because they determine Shmuel's fortunes in the course of his political career. Our story itself is going to begin with the Umayyad or Omayyad Caliphate. You often see it written Omayyad. I see that that becomes Oh My God on the transcript. That's interesting. They probably would have appreciated that. But it's often written Umayyad in texts that are a little bit more loyal to the original Arabic. They started out... The Umayyad Caliphate started out in Saudi Arabia before Islam. So they are Arab. They are not originally Muslim. Towards the end of Muhammad's life, they convert to Islam. So you're talking now 7th century. They are very powerful in that region. However, in the year 750 of the Common Era, they are routed by a new group called the Abbasids. You don't have to worry so much about them. We're not really going to be talking about them. But the key thing to know is that the Abbasids claim that they are the authentic heirs of Muhammad, and that the Umayyads are more distant, and therefore the Umayyads should give control to the Abbasids. The Umayyads are driven out, and they run away to Andalusia. Tell me, where is Andalusia?
Spain.
In Spain, correct. It's really the Iberian Peninsula.
South of Spain. It's the south of Spain.
Correct. The southern area of Spain. And they flee to this area, which at the time was under control of competing Arab tribes. And they create the Caliphate of Cordoba, from which they control the entire area there. Southern Spain, they control what is now Portugal. That whole area comes under their control in the late 8th century and only grows over time. And the rise of the Caliphate of Cordoba catalyzes the birth of a new Sephardic community in Andalusia. And that requires some explanation, obviously. The Talmud is completed in the middle of the 6th century Common Era, in Babylon. From that point onward, really starting a couple of generations after the conclusion of the Talmud, the Jews are led by 2 political figures. One is the Reish Galuta, Resh Galuta is usually translated in English as the exilarch. That's a political position. And the other is the Gaon. What does Gaon mean? So in modern Hebrew, Gaon means genius. That's how we use it. However, the origin of the term is it means the person with power. If you think of Ga'ava, for those who know the term Baal Gaiva or Gaiva, that means arrogance. But Ga'ava means power. Gaon was a religious figure, the head of the yeshiva, to whom people would address... Sorry, Diane, what?
The Gaon of Vilna.
So the use of the term for the Gaon of Vilna in the 18th century was a throwback. The meaning the period of the Gaonim really runs from the 7th century to the 11th century. But after their time, when you had somebody rise who was a remarkable figure, who everybody was in awe of their brilliance, they called them a Gaon. Today everyone's a Gaon, right? It's not enough to be a rabbi, you have to be a Rav Gaon. But the term itself, boy, this transcript is entertaining. The point is that the Gaon, this position of power was established because everybody from around the Jewish world would send their questions to the head of the yeshiva, the main yeshivot. We're in Babylon. We're what is today Iraq. And so you had a unity of the Jewish world around Iraq as the center. That was where the Talmud had been canonized. That was where the major academies were. That was where the money was, because it was near the center of the caliphate, the Abbasid caliphate at that time. So that was where all the power was. That was the center of gravity for the Jewish world. However, that changed when this new caliphate in Cordoba started. And the reason it changed...
Cordoba.
Yeah, no.
Cordoba.
Okay. If I say Cordova, it'll be more accurate to the Hebrew, but it won't be more accurate to the original word. But at least they write Cordova then. So there were two reasons why Jews in Spain started to become independent of this rest of the Jewish world that was centered in Babylon. Number one, the Umayyads were hostile to having the Jews go outside of Andalusia for their authority. They don't want the Jews associating with the Abbasids. They want the Jews to be within the Caliphate of Cordoba. So they don't want the Jews writing elsewhere for their authority. That's number one. Number two, there was a sage who we're not going to discuss much, but you have to mention him, Rabbi Moshe ben Chanoch. Rabbi Moshe ben Chanoch became a leading scholar in Andalusia in the 10th century. He was originally from Babylon. There's a whole story about how he was on a fundraising mission for the yeshiva in Babylon and then was captured by pirates, which happened a lot in those days, and they ransomed him to the Jewish community in Cordoba, and he became the leading scholar. So they didn't need to write away for their questions. They could ask him. Well, the result of this is that the Spanish Jewish community starts to develop homegrown authority instead of relying on the Gaonim from elsewhere. And so they start to develop their customs and their practices. At the same time that this is going on, the Abbasids are going into decline. And so the general authority of the central yeshivot of the Gaonim is diminished in the 10th century leading into the 11th. Everyone following? We're good? Okay. There's just a lot of history to cover in order for this to be...
How do you spell Abbasids? Can you spell it for us, please?
So Abbasid would be A-B-B-A-S-I-D-S. I'm going to write it in the chat also.
Okay.
I did actually... It's on the source sheet, actually. If you look at source number 7 on the source sheet, it's there as well.
Can I just ask you, what are the birth and death.
Right, so we're going to talk about that, but I'll tell you that he's born in Cordoba in 993. So that's our starting point, and he dies in 1056.
Thank you.
Sure. We're going to get to him. I'm just trying to provide the background first. So this brings us to the Berbers. Okay, right now you have a Muslim caliphate going in Cordoba. But in the beginning of the 11th century, there's a major shift within the caliphate. There's a series of assassinations and rebellions which result in the Berbers becoming the power behind the throne, because they are the enforcers for the caliph. And that's a very positive shift for the Jews, because the Berbers, even though a lot of them became Muslim, were not as anti-Jewish as the Arab population was. And again, we're going to come back to the question of the Golden Age that Susan mentioned. Diane asks a question in the chat. At this time, is there a similar Ashkenazi community? And the answer is, the Ashkenazim at this stage are also just in formation. The first Ashkenazi community technically is in Germany, but we're that hasn't happened yet at this stage. Before that, there's a community that develops in Italy, and that's the group that ultimately moves to Germany and becomes the first Ashkenazi community. The Italians have their own identity to this day, as a community. But what happens really is these groups that we now know about today are all splinters from that original community that followed the Gaonim. So you have a group that goes in there's a group that becomes more independent that's living in Spain, and they become Sfardim, Sfarad being a word that we use for Spain. There's a group that's in Italy, and they become more independent. There's a whole, we could spend a lot of time on that, the Clonimus family of rabbis in Italy. And then ultimately Rabbeinu Gershom is a leading figure in Germany, and that leads to the real breakaway, because he is a dynamic figure in his own right. So the Jews who are in Italy and how they got there is an interesting discussion. I mean, it has to do with the destruction of the Second Temple principally, but there's more to be said about it. Just not going there right now. Right now, I'm just going to stick with the Sfardim. So the Berbers become powerful politically, and that offers opportunity for the Jews as well. At that point, also, the caliphate, because of these assassinations and rebellions, has become a political mess. It's no longer a unified entity. And what you have instead are provinces that are called ta'ifas. If you take a look at source number 8 on your sheet, you'll be able to see that. And I think I'm actually going to call that up on mine and share the screen for it, because I want to highlight a couple of things for you within that. So just hang on for one moment.
What year are we talking
about? In the beginning of the 11th century. That's what we're talking about. And I'm going to share the screen. No, it's not allowing me. Zoom is being funny about it. Sorry, I'm not going to be able to share the screen with you. In order to do it, I'd have to restart Zoom, and I don't want to go through that right now. See if there's one thing I can do that may allow it. Let's see. Nope. Sorry, Zoom's not cooperating on this one. So
So this is
just before the Crusades. We're going to touch on that a little bit when we talk about what's going on in Israel at this point. But right now, Israel is under Muslim control. The Christians are not happy about it, but the Crusades themselves are only going to begin towards the end of the 11th century. So the if you have the source sheet, you'll see on there that the map of the Taifas in source number 8, I just put the link for the source sheet in the chat again. The main area that you want to look at in terms of our discussion is the area of Cordoba, which you can see right there in the middle. That's very important. And we're also going to be talking about two other areas that are worth noting. One is just southwest of Cordoba, and that's Seville. And the other is in the south along the coast, Malaga. So those are areas that we're going to need to talk about. But the Berbers coming into power in the beginning of that of the 11th century are important because, first of all, they're much looser about Islam in terms of its relationship with the Jews. The Umayyad caliphs had used Jewish help, but they would not give Jews high positions. The Berbers had no problem doing that. The only problem is that because there are all these assassinations and rebellions going on, you have to pick the right side as an ally. Otherwise, your friend today may be out of power tomorrow, and you go with him. Number two, aside from the political easing that comes with the Berbers, is that there's a new intellectual environment. Strict observance of Islam is relaxed. So if you look, for example, at artwork in that period, the artwork starts to include human images, which strict Islam did not allow. Strict Islamic art was basically calligraphy and designs. Now you start to see human figures. The philosophy is broader. There's a bigger acceptance of Greek thinking at that point. And intellectual Jews profit from this. They're no longer considered heretics. Now, make no mistake, under Berber or under Arab didn't make a difference in that Jews were still dhimmis, right? D-H-I-M-M-I-S. For the sake of the transcript, thank you, transcript. They were still dhimmis, meaning that they were recognized as a second-class citizen, having to pay a special tax, limitations on various elements of their social lives. There's a word which I'm going to write in the chat because I don't trust the transcript. The word is convivencia. We talked about this a few years ago in a class I gave at Beth Tikva when we talked about the Almohads. But to give a brief sense of it, the idea of convivencia is that there's a golden age when Jews, Christians, and Muslims all got along under Muslim rule, and the Dhimma rules were actually protecting Christian and Muslim minorities. It's an era that's supposed to have intellectual curiosity and artistic development and freedom for women. It's supposed to be like this magnificent period. And the Berbers were seen as a positive part of this. And the truth of the matter is, there were Jews who rose to high power, powerful positions, like Shmuel HaNagid. Another one was Chasdai ibn Shaprut, but we're not going to talk about him. However, historians, some of them at any rate, argue that this is a mistake, that convivencia is overblown. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 9 from historian Jonathan Ray in the journal Jewish Social Studies, he says, some regard medieval Iberian society as a model of tolerance and cross-cultural interaction. They argued that Spain is different from the rest of Latin Christendom, its civilization the product of a unique religious and cultural frontier that brought Muslims, Christians, and Jews together in close contact with one another. Castro's version, Castro being a historian, Castro's vision of Spanish history as the result of cross-cultural influences was challenged by his lifelong critic and counterweight, Claudio Sanchez Albornoz, who saw Muslims and Jews as having little impact on the formation of the Spanish character, and who argued that medieval Spanish culture is best characterized by conflict, not cooperation. And he goes on in that vein. It's not so clear that the golden age of Spain was so golden when it comes to Jewish life. Nonetheless, it's very clear that Shmuel HaNagid did very well. And now I want to turn to talk about him. Questions first now. And Terry put a note in the chat with a little etymology there on convivencia. Con meaning together, vivir, to live, living together. With an added encia for flair, I suppose. Yeah, I think that's a good translation, Eti. Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. Okay. So, let's talk Shmuel HaNagid. Bit of biography first. He came from a respected family from the city of Merida, which was within that area in Andalusia. The family were not nobles, but they were respected. And he moved to Cordoba because Merida became involved. The family moved to Cordoba because Merida became involved in rebellions and disputes. He was born in 993. He had an older brother as well, whose name was Isaac. We do not know about any other siblings. His older brother was very close with him. His older brother died in the year 1041, and Shmuel wrote a set of elegies, keynote, in his memory. Shmuel has a great education. Studies under great teachers, studies Hebrew, Arabic, Berber languages, European languages, Latin. He becomes a poet. We've already seen that. He's expert in the sciences as well, especially astronomy, geometry, and logic. He reads the Quran. He reads Muslim theologians as well. He reads Christian commentators on the Torah as well. He becomes a businessman. He apprentices to his father. He marries the daughter of the Dayan, rabbinical judge, of the court in Malaga, who was a close ally. I do not know the name of his wife. I have not been able to find it, despite looking quite a bit. They produce two sons who grow to adulthood, Joseph and Eliasaph. They also had a son and daughter who died in childhood. Shmuel was a devoted father. He directs the education of his children. His son Joseph accompanies him on many trips, and he trains Joseph to take his place as a leader in the Jewish community, which Joseph actually did. It is said that Joseph married the daughter of Rabbi Nissim Gaon, who was a leading Torah scholar in North Africa in that generation. So Shmuel is in Cordoba, active, until the year 1013, when he's 20 years old. He's 20 years old when the Berbers attack Cordoba, and the ruler of Cordoba was an Arab at the time. And the citizens in Cordoba had made a pact with the Berbers to spare their province. However, the treaties at that point, in that period of time, in that place, were generally speaking worthless. And the Berbers dropped the pact. They massacred many people, including many Jews. So Shmuel's family flees from Cordoba, and he becomes a trader in Malaga. Businessman. But he misses educated...
Malaga.
Sorry?
Malaga.
Malaga, thank you. I think of it as Malaga because of the wine. Malaga, thank you. So he misses the intellectual life. If you take a look at source number 10, Eliyahu Ashtor writes the following in The Jews of Muslim Spain. He's drawing here on Shmuel's own writings in Ben Tehillim when he says, "But as he sat in his shop..." Hang on one second, just admitting someone and muting by default because I'm getting background noise. "But as he sat in his shop in Malaga, he was overcome by depression and struggled powerfully with himself. There were no circles of young scholars or writers like himself with whom he could discourse and benefit thereby from their erudition, nor could he learn of or discuss new developments in literature and science. He suffered all the pain of one abruptly removed from his birthplace and all the misery of loneliness." He is very unhappy. He wants to accomplish more for the Jewish people, something he writes about in his verses. He has this Rabbi Judah, who was his father-in-law, the rabbinical judge in Malaga, and he also has another associate, a fellow who is known to us as Ibn Khazm. Ibn Khazm was a Muslim scholar with whom Shmuel would debate religion. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 11, I gave you an example of some of the things Ibn Khazm would say to him about the Torah. As was usual among Muslim theologians, Ibn Khazm sought to demonstrate that the Torah of Jews was fraudulent and was not the holy book of God. Among the various verses he cited as unethical, and thus proof of fraudulence, is the phrase in Genesis, "Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister." Where's that from? Can anyone tell me? Diane, you're muted.
Abraham and Sarah.
Good.
Abraham and Sarah.
Right.
That's what I thought.
When they go to Egypt, right? When they go down to Egypt, Abraham says to Sarah, "You should say, you are my sister," which is an act of deception. Well, Samuel Halevi, which is the way Ashtor describes the person we come to know as Shmuel HaNagid, replied that sister in Hebrew can also mean a kinswoman, which is true, and certainly in biblical Hebrew they did this all the time. Whereupon Ibn Khazm further cited the verse in Genesis 20:12, in which Abraham says, "Moreover, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother." And then Shmuel goes on to answer this. But the point is, he says, look, he's clearly they're clearly brother and sister. That's terrible. The Muslim theologian did not fail to introduce an old argument employed in all such debates. Ibn Khazm asked how Samuel would explain Genesis 49:10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." Anybody know where that's from? That's when Jacob gives blessings to each of his kids. And he gives a blessing saying, "Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda," the scepter shall not leave Judah, meaning they will be powerful politically going forward. And the Muslims would say, what happened to your powerful Jews from the tribe of Judah? Clearly your Torah is false. That was what they used to say. We had similar ideas from the Christians at the time. And Shmuel would respond, but what I'm trying to show you here is Shmuel is debating religion with a Muslim scholar there in Malaga, bemoaning the fact that he does not have Jewish peers to work with. Well, finally, he moves to Granada, and that's where his political rise begins. He becomes known for his erudition, his linguistic skills, and particularly for his Arabic writing. He becomes a writer of letters on behalf of powerful people there. He wrote letters on behalf of the stewards of someone by the name of Ibn al-Arif. Ibn al-Arif was the vizier of the Berbers in Granada, who were in control. So when you start writing letters for the people who work for him, you become important. On a visit to the area, al-Arif meets Shmuel, and he asks him to come work for him, as an official working on behalf of the government. He becomes a tax farmer, right? A tax farmer is somebody who pays the government for the right to be able to collect taxes from people for himself. So Shmuel becomes a tax farmer, and he's very successful. He even sends back to his father-in-law to come join him in Granada. But Shmuel runs into trouble, which teaches him a lesson for life. His trouble does not come from Arabs. His trouble does not come from Berbers. His trouble comes from other Jews who are jealous of his success. They don't like the fact that, number one, here's this outsider who comes in and he's doing very well. They don't like the fact that when he's succeeding, he invites his family to come in from Malaga instead of actually, taking the locals and elevating them. So they go to the government and they say, he's collecting too much. These taxes you licensed him to collect, he's taking too much, and he's becoming very rich off of it. And the result is that he's thrown in jail in the year 1020. They also hired thugs who attacked and killed the father-in-law, the judge from Malaga who had come to be with Shmuel. Well, Shmuel is ultimately released from the jail after paying a fine, naturally, and he loses his position. And from this, he learns a lesson that he keeps for life, which is, even if you're going to succeed, don't be seen to succeed. Don't let everybody else see your success, and then they become jealous. Well, Shmuel gets his job back. In the year 1027, he is appointed to collect taxes from all the Jews in the area. There's a word which I'm going to also put into the chat because it's one of those types of words that the transcript will not get. The word is sinhaja, or sinhaha, as the transcript does it. Sinhaja refers to a confederation of Berber tribes who control a large area together. And Shmuel becomes the tax collector for that entire area, and he becomes known among the Jews as what's called the Nagid, as I mentioned before, the leader or the prince. I actually see in my notes, I have to correct something I said earlier. I talked about him marrying the daughter of the judge from Malaga, who he brought with him. He actually doesn't marry her until now. He's been close with that judge all along. The judge at this point is dead. Only now does he end up marrying the daughter of that judge. I thought it was earlier.
So since when did he get the Tohar Nagid?
So at this point is when he gets the title, in 1027, when he becomes the tax collector for the Sinhaja.
But he's also ruler. Nagid is also ruler and a wealthy man.
Yes. Literally, the word Nagid means to pull people along. You have it in Aramaic as well as in Hebrew. The Nagid is somebody who can draw people along to follow. But Shmuel's rise is only just beginning. A man by the name of Chabus bin Maksen al-Muzaffar becomes the leader of Granada. Don't worry about all these names. They're not going to be on the final. It's okay. So this fellow Chabus becomes the leader of Granada. He himself is Arab, but he's supported by the Berbers. And Shmuel's job increases. He's still attached to this fellow Al-Arif, who was the Minister of Finance. Al-Arif's power grows as Granada becomes more powerful, and Shmuel, therefore, does very well. Now, this fellow Al-Arif, who was Shmuel's patron, really, does not let Shmuel meet Chabus, the leader of Granada, because he wants to take credit for what Shmuel is doing. Shmuel's cool with it. He says, I'm better off in the background. But ultimately, Al-Arif dies. And when Al-Arif dies, his son takes his place and is not up to doing the job. So Shmuel ends up appearing before Chabus in place of the son. He's still trying to stay in the background as much as he can, but ultimately Chabus makes him the vizier and minister of finance. So he is now minister of finance and chief advisor to the head of a very significant province, a very significant Taifa. There's a great story that goes with this. Take a look at source number 12, please. This story I've seen in a few different places. I took the version of it that appears in the Jewish Encyclopedia because I could cut and paste it. In his exalted position, Samuel remained the same pious and modest scholar and disarmed his enemies, who could not forgive him his Jewish faith, by his gentleness of manner and his liberality. We're going to talk about the enemies in a little bit. The following is an illustration of his magnanimity. A fanatical Mohammedan dealer in spices. They're at Mohammedan because the Jewish Encyclopedia was published in the very beginning of the 20th century. So that's the term that they're using at that point. A fanatical Mohammedan dealer in spices who lived near the caliph's palace once grossly offended Samuel while accompanying the caliph. Incensed at the offense, the caliph commanded Samuel to punish the fanatic by cutting out his tongue. Instead of executing this order, Samuel made a present to the offender and thus gained his gratitude. When the caliph again noticed the seller of spices, he was astonished at the change and questioned Samuel about it. I have torn out, answered the vizier, his angry tongue, and given him instead a kind one. I did what you told me to do, I just did it my own way, in his very gentle way. That's the type of story they tell about Shmuel HaNagid. Well, at this point, he faces a lot of political intrigue. There are Jews who are jealous of him, despite his efforts. There are also people who are looking ahead to the day when Chabus, the head of this Taifa, is going to die. And they're plotting as far as who should inherit from him. The Jewish aristocracy pick a fellow by the name of Balugin as their guy. Balugin does not like Shmuel. In addition to all of this, you have the city-state, or Taifa, of Almeria. And Almeria has a vizier, Ahmad bin Abbas, who was a Muslim, who saw Shmuel's role in Granada as a sign of Muslim decline. Why is there a Jew who's so powerful in Granada? And he lobbies the chiefs in Almeria to sever ties with Granada over this. So Shmuel is facing problems from Jews. He's facing problems from the people who are jockeying in position to inherit power when Chabus dies. And he's facing trouble from outside, from enemies who are saying, we want to cut ties with Granada because they have a Jew who's the minister of finance. Well, Shmuel survives all of it. Chabus dies in the year 1037. The Jews are supporting this fellow Balugin. However, Chabus had declared that he wanted a different heir to take control, a fellow by the name of Badis, and Balugin throws his support behind Badis because that's what his father wanted. And so the result of that is that this fellow Badis becomes in charge, and he trusts Shmuel, and therefore everybody else more or less has to fall into line. This brings us to Shmuel's first experience of war, because that still leaves the people in Almeria who are not happy that Shmuel is in charge in Granada. So the new power, Badis, in Granada tries to make peace with Almeria. Almeria is not interested. They have a king by the name of Zuhair. And Zuhair of Almeria comes to visit, but not in a friendly way. He comes to visit trying to get Shmuel dropped. Badis is not interested. Zuhair is on his way home. Badis says, I'm going to send troops to destroy the bridge ahead of him on his way home and then ambush him. He says, I'm getting rid of this guy who's the king of Almeria. I don't want strife with Almeria anymore. I want to get rid of this guy. But at the last minute, he gives this fellow Zuhair another chance, decides not to blow up the bridge, saying, you know what? Let's see if we can make peace with him. And actually he does. He destroys the bridge, but then he sends an agent to him warning him, don't go that route, go a different route. Well, that doesn't help. Doesn't matter. Almeria continues anyway to pursue, and ultimately they create a war. They trigger a war with Granada. The Almerians are routed. Their leadership is captured. Badis kills the anti-Shmuel advisor himself. And Shmuel writes a long poem about his salvation in this story, which he sends to Jewish communities all over Europe and North Africa. And he declares the day Purim of Granada. There's a long tradition in Jewish history of communities declaring a day Purim when they were saved from some disaster. So that's what Shmuel does here. And his position from then on is solidified within Granada and beyond its boundaries as well. Questions? Before we go further? I'm doing a lot of monologuing, I know. It's just a lot of history. Eti. Yeah, if you go back to the map that I gave you, if you look in the southeast part of the Taifas, you'll see Almeria on the coast. Do you see that?
Yeah.
That's where it is. Okay. So Shmuel's position at this point is solidified. Shmuel is doing well. But for all his success among the Berbers, Shmuel does not feel comfortable with them. He holds himself apart. He doesn't feel like he belongs there. He considers them crude. He considers their entertainments crude. He certainly is not a part of them religiously. And he credits his survival and his success to the merit of his ancestors as opposed to their ancestors. That's the way he presents it in his writings. He dresses in their official manner. He wears a turban, the whole bit. But he never tries to pass as them. He's very clear about his Jewish identity. And that's where I want to go next, is Shmuel as a Jewish leader. We have already seen he composes poems in Hebrew. He also composes poems in Arabic and in Aramaic, and on a broad range of subjects. Friendship, enemies, military victory, faith in God, drinking songs, love poems, grief and mourning, dreams of Aliyah to Israel. Israel at this point is controlled by the Fatimids out of Egypt. So he dreams of making Aliyah. And he assembles his poems into three collections. One is called Ben Tehillim. Ben, of course, means son of. The idea is that it's a miniature version of Tehillim, Psalms. And these are religious poems. Second is Ben Mishlei, which is proverbs on life and goals, like we saw in the poems that we introduced. And then he has a third one, which I didn't bring you any excerpts from, which is called Ben Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, which are proverbs about death, the meaning of life, and God's decrees. You see, obviously, that he's modeling his literary legacy on three key books from Tanakh, which are books with their own character and their own pedigree, and he's adopting that as his model. Yes, Susan.
When you say Hebrew, what Hebrew, like, was it a Torah Hebrew? Like, what Hebrew did they have in those days?
Yeah. It's poetic Hebrew. I mean, let me explain a little bit. You have biblical Hebrew, obviously. You have rabbinic Hebrew, which, you know, is plentiful. At this point in history, there's a lot being published in Hebrew. You also have a lot in Arabic, but you have significant amounts that are being published in Hebrew. And then you have the Hebrew of the poets, the Paitanim. And they were more creative with their Hebrew in pursuit of meter and rhyme and so on. So you see words that become a little bit warped. So for example, actually, I'll give you an example of it that I noticed. If you go back to the poems that I brought in the beginning, in number three, in the beginning, the first part of it, Krav Dome Berosho El Yefefa. Yefefa is his term for a beautiful girl, but it really should be Yefefia. That's the word in Tanakh. But it wouldn't fit his meter if he did that. So it becomes Yefefa. So you have some freedom that the poets had. I'm looking at the time and I realize it's 10:59. I knew I wouldn't get everything in about Shmuel today. I'd hope to get in more, but that's my practice in general, is to hope to get more. So what we're going to do next time, we had to spend some time on background of Sephardic Judaism, where none of this would have made any sense. Now that we know about how Sephardic Judaism came to be, and that we're focusing on this area in Andalusia at this, you know, at this stage, next time what I want to do is talk about Shmuel as a Jewish leader and somebody who has a legacy within Torah and within Judaism. Continuing from that, to talk about Shmuel as a leader of the Jews and his communal role. And then I want to talk about him as a general, because that's fascinating in its own right. He becomes the minister of war and a general. And then move on to talk about Nachmanides. We're going to be jumping ahead in time to the 13th century for that. Thank you very, very much. I would also be curious. I'm going to just turn off the audio recording.